This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women who have put their lives on the line for our freedom. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, do we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The gentleman we're going to hear from today is 91 years young, originally from Minnesota by way of Canada, a high schooler in Bend, Oregon, but for the last quarter century here in Clovis, California, where he's still serving, and we'll tell you about that, what he's up to these days. George Hansen, my guest today, veteran of the 11th Armored Division in World War II, recipient of the Purple Heart. But long before that, just a young guy following your dad around in the lumber business. You saw quite a bit of the northern U.S. and Canada as a youngster, didn't you?
I really did. I saw lumber camps and saw how they take the lumber and put it into boards and sell it to people.
And you told me you really wanted to be a pilot. When did that dream of getting up in the sky and fighting enemies or just flying, when did that originate?
When I was young in Canada, we lived on a lake and there was a dock and planes would land there in the wintertime on skis, in the summer on pontoons. And I thought, I want to be a pilot someday. And the desire grew and grew till I became a pilot.
Tell me what you remember about being in high school in Bend, Oregon. And maybe some folks have been through Bend. Maybe they've gone skiing over there at Mount Bachelor or something. But what was it like back then in the late 30s and early 40s?
Well, it was a dirt road up to where the ski area is now. And we used to go up there for camping and just for hiking. And then later on, after I got out of the Army, I went there to Mount Bachelor to go skiing.
What were you into in high school? I know you're still playing this French horn over here now. Were you doing that back then?
Yeah, my mother wanted me to try to get in a band, so I got in the orchestra, and they said, here, take a French horn and play the French horn. So that's where I got started on a French horn.
And you're still playing?
I still play. For 40 years, my horn was in the closet, and then my church started an orchestra. And I got the horn out of the closet, and I'm still playing there about 10 years later.
Are you the oldest one in the orchestra at 91? Is there someone who's got you beat?
There was one guy a year and a half older who just died, so now I am the oldest.
Outstanding. Well, don't slow down on that. So you graduated in 1941, and about 6 months later, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Every veteran I've talked to seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day?
I was in Los Angeles going to Westmont College, which was there at the time, and I'll never forget Pearl Harbor. And then the city started blackouts, so at night there wouldn't be a lot of lights on, and you'd wonder if the Japanese were going to come and bomb Los Angeles, which they never did.
Well, some people may know Westmont is now in Santa Barbara, which was the one spot on the California coast that actually was hit by the Japanese at that point. Santa Barbara took a couple shells, but what I've heard from people who were in L.A. at the time was, like you say, blackouts and concern that Japanese bombers might be coming. Is that something that was real to you, that you expected something like that to happen?
Well, we knew it could happen, but I don't think I ever really thought it would happen.
Well, thankfully, it didn't. And you're there at Westmont, but we've already talked about it. You had this dream of being a pilot, and you tried to do something about that, didn't you?
Well, they didn't want me in the Air Force because I'm colorblind, but after I got out of the Army, I discovered that you can get a private pilot's license. I could never be a commercial pilot, which is fine with me now, but I could get a pilot's license, which I did. I still like to fly, but I haven't flown for 2 or 3 years now.
So it was just a dream delayed when the Army Air Corps said, no, colorblind, we can't take you. And the Navy kind of told you the same thing. So was that a disappointment to you at the time? Here you are trying to go serve your country, and they say no thanks?
No, it was a disappointment. But I've discovered that God has something better, and it's not always what we want. It's what he shows you that you should be doing.
So finally, Uncle Sam said, hey, we want you now. We want you in the Army. But as folks have heard from some other veterans on this program, you entered a training program, the Army Specialized Training Program, which was really going to college and training a little bit, but really studying a lot. And you were studying engineering at Santa Clara?
That's right, for about 6 months. And then they decided they don't need any more engineers, so they just went down to Lompoc, which was the 11th Armored Division training place, getting ready to go overseas, and we just filled in empty spots. And I had never dreamed of being in a machine gun squad, but there I was, now assigned to a machine gun squad.
Had you ever fired a machine gun before?
Never. Although I grew up with guns and loved to go hunting in Oregon, and so I'm familiar with guns, but not a machine gun.
So here you are. You're not even 20 years old yet, but you're facing the prospect of heading overseas in a machine gun squad. Did that sound like a dangerous job, dangerous duty for you?
You know, I don't think I thought too much of the danger till later on. However, I always wanted to be involved in this war, and all the young guys wanted to be in some kind of service, Navy or Army or Air Force or Coast Guard or something. And so everybody was for you, and our country wasn't divided. We were all together wanting to win these two wars.
And what was it for you personally that made you so motivated, that drove you to want to go do something?
I think it was part of our culture. Most young guys wanted to go and get involved because we thought it was something that was for the good of our country. And then I've always kind of liked adventure and new exciting things. And to me, it was exciting.
Well, and you would get more than your share of excitement over there in Europe. And you've lived quite an exciting life since then. And I guess I should touch on something chronologically here. Because since you made it home from World War II, since you're able to meet your wife and have all your children, and now you've got 13 grandchildren and working on great-grandchild number 10, you had to survive all the war to do that. But your life after the war involved the ministry. And there was something that happened that I guess kind of was a spark in terms of you getting into the ministry. Do I have that right?
Yes. You know, when I got to England and they said any day we're going to France, and that's where people were getting killed. During my high school years, sometimes they would ask young people like me if we were willing to be a pastor or a missionary. And I always thought, well, that's fine. I love pastors. I love missionaries. But I want to be a pilot. I want to get in the Air Force and have the excitement of flying an airplane. So that was my desire, which didn't work because I'm colorblind. They didn't want me. They don't want colorblind pilots stopping, landing when the red light is blinking at the end of the runway. So I just waited till I was drafted, and then, as I mentioned, I ended up in the infantry.
But I think you started to tell me, so you get over there in Europe, and this is 1944. You went over to England in September of 44, and 6 weeks later, you were heading over to France. Before you went across that channel, you did something that so many guys have done. Some have regretted it. Some have been thankful for it, but you made a bargain with God?
Yeah, I don't know if you should make bargains with God, but I did. I said, God, if you get me out alive, I'll do anything with the rest of my life that you want me to do. I'd even be a preacher. I'd even be a missionary. And so God heard me, and he started answering my prayer in different ways.
Well, and we're going to hear about some of those ways. And I don't know if you were exaggerating, but I know you told me you could count at least 7 times where you felt your life was spared during your time in World War II. So I know we all want to hear about some of those. But do you remember, aside from that little conversation with God there, do you remember what your anticipation was, or the feeling that you had before your first taste of combat?
You know, somehow, and I think everybody hopes that they won't be the one that gets killed or even injured, but I just sort of had a gut feeling that this won't happen to me. I'll make it.
So you told us a machine gun squad with the 11th Armored Division. What was your specific role in that squad?
Okay, they have 3 guys indicated. The squad leader uses the 50 caliber machine gun. Then 2 guys in the back where you have 9 guys in 2 rows. 2 of them have a machine gun. The rest of us just have a rifle. like a regular foot soldier.
Where was your first taste of combat? What do you remember about those moments?
I remember that one night we were heading towards the city of Bastogne, and we stopped at night and went to sleep on the ground next to a haystack. And we thought, well, we'll have a good night's rest here by this haystack. And about 10 o'clock, the captain says, we're moving out. So we got in our armored column, tanks in the front, and then half tracks with machine gun squads and other foot soldiers, and we're headed for Bastogne.
And tell us why it was so important to get to Bastogne, because the timing of this was the Battle of the Bulge, right?
That's right, and there were hundreds of soldiers there surrounded by Germans, and our goal was to go and rescue them. So we're on the way up there, and I'm in the back riding along, a couple tanks in front, and then behind us other trucks with more soldiers. And all of a sudden, about 11 o'clock at night, this explosion wakes up the guys like me that were sort of dozing in the back as we went along in this armored column. And it was an explosion. A German shell had come and landed right in the middle of the nine of us in the back. The explosion woke us up if we were asleep. And I immediately felt that my leg on my left side was, I thought it was blown off. So I started feeling to see where it ended. And I got to my foot, and I was very happy that I still had a foot and a leg. But it was numb from the explosion, which ripped off my overcoat that had a hand grenade in it and a camera I carried. And I couldn't feel a thing. But they said, get out of this vehicle fast. So I got out. And, you know, isn't it interesting how God treated me? There was a medic's jeep right behind our vehicle. The nurses or whoever they were, guys with first aid caps on their head, they took me in this jeep to a field hospital, and then the next day to a hospital where I spent a few weeks in a warm room having meals in bed being treated by American nurses. And I thought, wow, am I ever blessed to be alive and to be here? While the rest of my buddies were for 2 days pinned down by the German artillery, sleeping in the snowbanks.
Yeah, you talk about something that could have saved your life, maybe being shaken up and wounded, and you did get the Purple Heart for that incident. Maybe that did save your life. And more about that shell, so we can understand how amazing it is that you did survive as intact as you were. You said it tore your overcoat off, smashed all the contents, and it also put a hole in the floor of this metal half track?
That's right. And sitting right next to me, it was very snug back there with all of us together with our heavy overcoats on and a gun in our hand. The guy next to me was killed immediately. They said it kind of blew up his insides. And the one sitting across from him who's my feet were touching was also killed immediately, and a couple others were wounded. So when a few weeks later when I went back to my organization, it was a new bunch of replacements except for two or three guys of the 12, and the captain says, George, now you are the squad leader. So I took over as the squad leader.
Wow. I know you've lived with that for more than 70 years, but is it a little hard for you to believe that the guy on either side of you, the guy to your right and the guy to your left, they're both killed, that you think you lost your leg, but you didn't, it's intact, and you didn't even bleed?
Well, you know, I said, God, if you get me out alive, I'll do anything. And I began to think, well, he kept me alive through this, and I wonder what's next.
And you said you spent 3 weeks in hospitals as opposed to the worst winter that Europe had ever seen out there in the foxholes. But what were those 3 weeks like? What kinds of things were going through your mind, and how did you occupy your time?
I really don't remember. I just looked forward to the next meal, which they brought me in bed. And then about a week before I left, I finally could get up and walk. And I remember walking down the street in this town in France, and I noticed a sign of an honor thing for Joan of Arc, and discovered that Joan of Arc, who was one of the French heroes in the past, this was the town where she grew up and lived.
You mentioned having to be able to walk again. Did it take 3 weeks to get the feeling back in your leg, to have that coordination again?
I think after the first week, the feeling was really really coming back, but I think my leg must have been somewhat swollen, evidently, because they wouldn't let me go till I could walk with ease.
It's time to catch our first break, but there are more close calls, more examples of what this 91-year-old pastor and missionary sees as divine protection as he fought the rest of the war in Europe. You'll find photos of George Hansen then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.